This episode of the Kenai Conversation was broadcast on Wednesday, August 21st. If you hear any dated references, please disregard them. And if we give out the phone number, you can safely ignore that as well. You're listening to Public Radio KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jay Barrett. And it's time for the Kenai Conversation. This morning, we're talking with folks from CIRCAC, the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council. We have Mike Munger, the Executive Director, John Williams, the Board President, and the Public Outreach Director, Linda Giger. Did I get that right? Did I?
Sounded great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, welcome all you to the studio. Mike, I'm particularly thrilled to get you here. I missed you so many times by one day or 2 days or something, but it's terrific to get you in the studio.
It's good to be here, Jay.
Yeah. John, good to have you back in the studio again.
Always a pleasure to be out here with you, Jay. Always enjoy it.
Yeah. And welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Mike is only here for the first half hour, so maybe we should start with maybe you could give us an overview of CIRCAC. It came about after the Exxon Valdez oil spill 30 years ago, after the Pollution Prevention Act. What is it? Why don't you go ahead?
Well, thank you, Jay. We were formed as part of legislation called the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, and typically that's referred to as OPA 90. And there was two citizens advisory councils to monitor the oil industry's activities in Alaska. One is in Prince William Sound, and that was the epicenter, of course, of the Exxon Valdez spill. And the other Citizens Advisory Council, which is the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, we monitor the oil activities in the Cook Inlet region. And when I say the Cook Inlet region, our boundaries are defined by the line basically across from Point Possession, across in the northern inlet, and Anatoly Island in the bottom of the inlet. That's our area of responsibility. Our area of concern, though, is from Anchorage down to Kodiak, because as we all know in the dynamic tides of Cook Inlet, if there was an oil spill in Cook Inlet, those regions would be affected. And so we have representation from Anchorage down to Kodiak. We have a 13-member board of directors. My standard line to describe the Citizens Advisory Council is we're a federally mandated Citizens Advisory Council that oversees oil transportation and operations in Cook Inlet. As I just mentioned, we have a 13-member board of directors that includes seven municipality seats, which is the municipality of Anchorage, the city of Kenai, Kenai Peninsula Borough, City of Homer, City of Soldovia, City of Kodiak, and the Kodiak Island Borough. We have six special interest seats on our council, which includes tourism, Alaska Native organizations, aquaculture, recreational groups, commercial fishing,
environmental and tourism.
And environmental groups.
And tourism.
We have, in the special interest groups, each seat represents a number of organizations. So in total, the organizational membership, excluding the municipalities, cities, seats, is around 46 seats, or 46 organizations. So we're a broad swath of stakeholder representation in Cook Inlet, and so that's kind of where we're at.
Wow, that is a lot of buy-in from a lot of different groups. When OPA 90 was being promulgated, was Cook Inlet included in the beginning, or were they focusing just on Prince William Sound, and you know, what did it take to get Cook Inlet included?
You know, why I'm that old, Jay, I don't know exactly I've certainly heard anecdotal information. I think the focus originally was on the the Valdez region, of course, the epicenter of the, you know, the oil spill in 1989. But through the work of Mayor Don Gilman at the time, and we have sitting with us one of the original oiled mayors, and John can speak to that. But they insisted that there was a Citizens Advisory Council in Cook Inlet also.
John, could you speak to that a little bit, the beginning years?
Yeah, it came about because we were having problems over here, just like they were in Valdez with some oil spills and one thing and another. But the mayors, at the time I was president of the Alaska Conference of Mayors, and we put together a group of mayors that were in villages along the coast, the coastal mayors. We called ourselves the oiled mayors. And I remember one of the legislators down in Juneau saying, can you imagine those guys calling themselves oiled mayors? But we made several visits during the period of time that the cleanup was taking place over there. And we also formed an international committee that traveled to over to France and to, I'm trying to remember where the
Shetland
big
Islands.
Shetland Islands, and of course they had Marathon had a large spill over in that region too. And the mayors over there insisted that we put something together and that we put it together in such a manner that it would be long-lasting, because their say to us was that you're not going to settle this thing for the next 15 or 20 years. That always rings in my ears because that's exactly what happened. So we went forward then back to Washington, D.C., to our congressional delegation, along with the Valdez people, and we urged them to, of course, include the Cook Inlet in the whole issue. And the reason that the Cook Inlet was so interested in, and today it shows its point very clearly, the Cook Inlet is a major source of our economy for this central part and the entire state of Alaska, as a matter of fact. When you take a look at what happens on the Cook Inlet with not only oil and freight and fishing and tourism and everything that goes into it, and the Cook Inlet needs to be protected, and that's why we're here.
Are there more than just the two RCACs? Are there, do they have RCACs like on the Gulf of Mexico? Or
No. There are some citizens advisory councils related to the oil industry, but not formed under Open 90. I believe there's one in New Jersey. But disappointingly, after the Deepwater Horizon spill, a number of the reports that came out of the Deepwater Horizon spill recommended forming citizens advisory councils in that area. But the only thing that came out of the Deepwater Horizon spill as far as any mandates or legislation was they bifurcated an existing federal agency, which was Mineral Management Services, and they bifurcated that into two separate agencies, and that was it. So, but there was quite a bit of talk, quite a bit of activity after the Deepwater Horizon about forming the Citizens Advisory Council there, but it never came to fruition.
Wow. So you folks are funded by industry, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a federal requirement.
Mm-hmm. Does the declining of the industry affect your budget?
No.
No?
No. As long as oil is being transported or produced in Cook Inlet, we're funded to the level that's required in Open 90.
Oh, wow. And the subsequent reauthorizations, right? I mean, I assume you guys are getting more money than you did in 1990.
That's built into Open 90.
Oh, okay.
We also, a good portion of my job or a significant portion of my job is going out and seeking additional funding. We, over the years, we've been fairly successful in both with state and federal partners in moving some of our projects and activities forward. A lot of our work in scientific monitoring is extremely expensive and far exceeds the level of funding that is required in Open 90. More and more, as we were discussing before we got on the air, federal and state funding is hard to come by.
Yes, yes, it is. Does your level of funding ever get attacked by a political anybody? Oil industry or support industry?
We've received criticism in the past that there's an inherent conflict of interest that we're monitoring the industry that's required to fund us. I don't believe that. We remain autonomous from the influence of the industry. We work very well with the oil industry in Cook Inlet. One of the things that Open 90 focuses on when they're talking about the formation of the RCAC is that there needs to be not so much confrontation and distrust, but there has to be a conduit between the citizens and the industry and both the state and federal regulators that oversee the industry. And so we view the industry and the state and federal agencies as a partnership. And as many partnerships, that there's many times that we don't agree. But it works very well in Cook Inlet. We've gotten a tremendous amount done for the funding that we do have, and we continue to do that. And I will have to say, and I don't say this lightly, industry has been very, very cooperative working with the Citizens Advisory Council, frankly, since their inception. And again, we don't always agree with the oil industry, but we find that you get a lot more done when you're working in a spirit of cooperation rather than a spirit of confrontation.
Wow. You know, I read on your website there was a rundown of how you came about, and they were talking about the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And I recall this from the time. There was an impression that there was complacency on the part of regulators overseeing the oil industry that led to the EVOs. And that sounds like what your organization is trying to avoid.
Right. Yeah, complacency is our big enemy. And I've seen it happen. I've been involved with the oil industry in one form or another since 1974. I'm an ancient. But as there'll be some disaster like the Exxon Valdez, and there's complacency that led to the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, and then there is either legislation or initiatives, and people get very, very involved, and then if you don't have another spill or an incident for years, you find that complacency will keep creeping back in because the politicians don't see it as a primary responsibility. There's other things going on. Funding becomes more challenging, and it's just kind of this constant up and down cycle. And what we try to do at CERCAC is make sure that it doesn't cycle, and we keep a focus on making sure complacency doesn't come into this, because frankly, a significant spill on Cook Inlet would be devastating on so many fronts. Not only the oil industry itself, that would shut down, the commercial fishing would shut down, and frankly, we are the gateway of all the bulk goods coming into Alaska itself. If you disrupt that, you're disrupting major economic engines. So we just can't let complacency come back into what, in my opinion, led to the Exxon Valdez.
What are the day-to-day things that CERCAC does to advance those goals?
We only have an hour, Jay.
Well, I only got you for 15 more minutes.
Well, obviously you've been to our website. You've seen the numerous projects and initiatives that we've taken. For example, one of the things that we've been working on since I've been with the council, and I've been with the council since right at the end of 2000. But we've, as you well know, Cook Inlet is a dynamic body of water. the second highest tides in North America, broken ice conditions many months out of the year. We've always wanted to make sure that the infrastructure in place in Cook Inlet, when the vast majority of it's been put in the mid-1960s, is operating with structural integrity and will operate into the future with that same integrity. And so we've always wanted to take a really close look at the infrastructure, do a whole assessment on the infrastructure, specifically on this one that we're doing now, the Cook Inlet infrastructure assessment, is specifically taking a look at the pipelines that transport oil to and from our to shore, and also the associated fuel gas, natural gas lines that that run the platforms. And so that's just one example of what we're doing, and we're going to complete that by the end of the year. We've had major cooperation with industry, and it's also funded. It's funded in jointly by through the with the state of Alaska. The Kenai Peninsula Borough has put funding towards it. Certainly, our funding, and so we're wrapping that up by the end of the year. We have comprehensive, ongoing scientific monitoring going on constantly in Cook Inlet. And frankly, the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the scientific monitoring. That kind of stuff always gets my attention. You got like, what have you got out there?
Well, I'm going to turn it over to Linda. Actually, we had an environmental monitoring committee meeting yesterday in Homer. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend, and Linda can actually speak to some of our current projects a lot better than I can.
I think one of the more recent ones we're working on is has to do with studying how oil reacts to marine snow, which is the organics within the water columns themselves. We're supporting a thesis study by a student from the University of New Hampshire who's been collecting samples in the inlet. And then we're going to have a presentation on that at our next board meeting. So one of the things we do study is, you know, how oil behaves, oil, and that's one of our program areas. Other work that is done in the inlet has to do with habitat mapping, you know, identifying what's on the shorelines, identifying the sensitive areas, helping oil spill responders know in advance, you know, if oil is heading to a certain area, what is there. We'll already be able to identify that, and that will help us design oil spill response for that particular site. Those are two very important areas. Sue Soppy is our director of science and research and spends considerable time in the field. And I always wish she were here because she can talk in greater detail and depth about the amazing work she does in the field.
You know, I interviewed her once from when I was down in Kodiak over the phone about the inlets of refuge or ports of refuge. What was it called? Mapping the whole shoreline of pretty much all of South Central Alaska, and it came in handy not long after she did that when that floating drill rig,
the Kulik,
snapped loose there in Kodiak one New Year's Eve.
Well, shore zone mapping was a pilot project that CERCAC introduced to Alaska and took it another step further by marrying the high-resolution imagery with real-time data and information on the shorelines. And that project was so successful and grew so fast that it I think that it consists now of Alaska Shore Zone of more than 40 partners who have since taken over the project and are mapping the entire state shoreline. So that was a CERCAC-initiative. We're really proud of that. And as you say, it did help with the Kulik response because we were able to tell them what was on the shoreline. It was a very remote area, so then you're you're promoting safety of your personnel in addition to, you know, planning how to respond. You're preventing potential accidents from happening because you know what's going to be there, what to expect. It just gives you that many more tools to work with. Something that we've also developed as an offshoot of that is the Cook Inlet Response Tool to help responders by giving them all those data, all those layers of data. You can access this information from your laptop. And so you're getting as much information in hand before heading into the response itself, so you're fully prepared to do a better job.
Wow. Now, are these projects like this Shore Zone coastal mapping initiated by CERCAC, is this, what are the mandated programs and what are the programs that you initiate? Is there a difference, or is this all fall under what's mandated?
Well, we developed a strategic plan based on the mandates under the Oil Pollution Act. It tells you what to do. The law doesn't tell you exactly how to do it, so we developed the strategic plan, and then from that strategic plan we developed our programs and projects. So within our strategic plan we have contingency plan review, technical review, risk assessment, prevention and response, environmental and chemical, biological and chemical monitoring, habitat mapping. What am I missing?
There are a number of projects, Jay. You mentioned recertification. To make sure that we're doing our business correctly on an annual basis, the Coast Guard, for lack of better terms, is our overseeing agency to make sure that we do our business correctly. They review our activities. They compare them to the mandates in OPA 90, make sure that we're spending our funding correctly towards OPA 90 related projects. And that's the way that works. So we have a check and balance too. We just don't gather money and then go off willy-nilly, basically. And we've just received our recertification for this year, and that is 28 years of recertification without exception, and very, very proud of that.
Wow. Turn my mic up. Wow, that's pretty impressive. Why is that every year? I mean, you'd think that, they could see you're doing a good job. I mean, do they have, larger reviews periodically, but every year you have, like, a checklist or something?
Well, what we just went through this year doesn't have a public comment component. And we basically report our activities to the Coast Guard of any significant activities from the last recertification. Every third year, we go through a recertification, lay it all out. The public can weigh in on it if they want to. But frankly, I think that we've demonstrated, like I said, in 28 years, we've been recertified without exception. It certainly wouldn't hurt my feelings to go to a less rigorous standard on recertification, but we do what the federal government asks us to do. So, and I can't speak to the wisdom of the federal government.
Sure. What's the relationship between the Cook Inlet RCAC and the Prince William Sound RCAC? Are you guys on the phone ever or meet?
Well, actually, we work pretty closely together. There are different organizations and different geographical location and different interests, but at the end of the day, we have the same federal mandates, both organizations. Interestingly enough, they oversee the oil transportation in the Valdez Marine Terminal, the terminus of the pipeline, and that's their responsibilities. We have oil production, so we have oil, of course, the oil platforms out in Cook Inlet. We have the refinery on the shore. We have drilling and exploration going. And so, frankly, we have quite a bit more activity to oversee, but that's just the nature of where we're at. But back to your question, we've been working more and more with the Prince William Sound RCAC, and there are areas of commonality where we join forces and comment. We feel that having both the organizations work together on some issues just gives a stronger voice to the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
I will attribute a lot of that success of the relationship with Prince William Sound RCAC and Kokanet RCAC to their executive director, Donna Shantz, a wonderful person to work with.
Where do I know her name from? What did she do before she worked there?
Don't know what she did beforehand. She's been a long-term employee of the organization of Prince William Sound RCAC. I think she's been with the organization for 18 years, around that too.
Maybe that's where I heard her name from.
She was a staff person for many years over there and worked her way up through the ranks. Yeah.
She may have been in public radio before.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Well, Mike, you got 5 minutes before you're bugging out of here. I just saw in the news here recently that you guys are part of a program with industry and Avtec.
Yes.
Doing some. What is it? It's boat driving, right? What is that called? Skippering? Not skippering. Master class of boat driving.
Well, what we've done, and we have, and Linda can speak to our scholarships a lot better than I can, and that's why she's our director of public outreach. But recently we entered into a partnership with Marathon, and we see a lack of folks or young folks getting into the maritime industry, and so they need able-bodied seamen. They need all that, all the way up to captain. And so we saw that need, and we've worked closely with the Avtec Center in Seward. But recently, we decided to do a partnership scholarship for folks looking to get into the maritime field with Avtec, and that's a $2,500 scholarship, and that looks like it's going to be, that's not just a one-year thing, it looks like it's going to be an ongoing partnership, and we're real excited about that. And we also have two other scholarships that we look at, and I'll have Linda describe those.
Oh, sure. But first, they have a bridge simulator at Avtec, don't they?
Yeah. Frankly, state of the art.
Yeah.
We've done a number of studies using that bridge or using that simulator. And it's a awesome thing to have in Alaska. And specifically, they have it designed to where they can simulate ice conditions in Cook Inlet. When you're literally on the simulator, it feels like you're driving a boat in Cook Inlet, enough so where you look around and the participants are all kind of swaying along, you know. It's a remarkable simulation.
Oh, man.
And I will have to say that Marathon has done a stellar job of providing additional funding continue to develop that simulator.
That's great. That's great. Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming in this morning. You promised me a half an hour, and the half an hour is up. Let me give out our phone number, 283-8414. We will be taking your phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation in the next half hour with John Williams and Linda Giguere, the board president and director of public outreach for CIRCAC. And we will talk about more scholarships when we come back after a short break. You're listening to the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jay Barrett. My guests this half hour, John Williams and Linda Giguere, are sticking with me from CIRCAC. John is the board president, and Linda is the public outreach director. And I want to thank Mike Munger for coming in for the first half hour. He had some other things he had to take care of for the second half hour. We're talking during the break here. We're talking about the Drift River terminal over there. For years, for seemingly forever, perhaps they took oil by barge from there over to here, over to Nikiski. And they just stopped doing that recently. And you guys were supporters of that idea.
Yeah, for several years, we were supporting the idea of abandoning Drift River altogether. As you know, those that know the layout of the systems, they ship oil from up north via pipeline from the producers all the way to Drift River. Then they put it on a barge at Drift River, and they haul it all the way back up to Tesoro. And put it off into the refinery. I shouldn't say Tesoro anymore. They're now owned, I think, by Marathon. But at any rate, after the volcano blew up and it so destroyed the place over there, it was a wake-up call. We knew that something had to be done because that volcano will go off again. So we were very supportive of the idea of abandoning that area and building an underwater pipeline from the northern terminus or the northern part of the production area across the inlet and into the refinery so that we wouldn't have to barge. It took quite a while to accomplish that, but in the end, I'm very pleased to say, and most of the inlet is pleased to say, that Drift River will no longer be. It is being abandoned now. We are shipping oil via pipeline, underwater pipeline, from the west side to the east side, and Drift River will be undergoing demolition. It will be completely removed, and all of the materials out there will be taken away. So that was one of our great accomplishments.
How big of a tank farm was that, or terminal?
Well, it's big. I think, is there four tanks or
four to six? I thought there were two that were, and I'm not exactly sure. But I thought there were two that were empty, and that there were four that.
There's four tanks over there. I've been over there and toured the place. But let me tell you, these are not your everyday homegrown tanks either. You could play football inside one of these tanks. They're so big. I mean, they are huge. In fact, when we were over there on a field trip, they were using one of the tanks as a warehouse and storage unit for heavy equipment. You know, they had cut a large hole in the side of the tank, and you could drive a truck through there.
So, really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. How long do you think it's going to take to clean it up?
Well, I don't know. It's my understanding that there is a contractor been hired, and the demolition will soon be underway to remove the tank farm in its entirety.
Oh. Are they shipping oil now on the pipeline?
They are, yes. The pipeline is in full force, and I have to give credit to the folks that built it, to Hillcorp. I think the cost of that pipeline was over $40 million, as I recall. I had questioned them about that at the time, and they said, yeah, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $42, $43 million. Big investment.
Yeah, that was a reasonably complex operation with new pipeline on the other side, mm-hmm. new pipeline across the way, and then switching one pipeline to do something else, as I recall.
Yeah, they use a tugger barge to pull the line from the other side out into the ocean, and then, of course, they had to tie in under the sea, and it was quite a project, $43 million worth. So.
Man. Yeah, you're also going to mention the platforms. Are they all still producing out there, or what's the deal with them?
Many of them are. Some of them aren't. Some are in what we call lighthouse status. They're just there. I know one produces gas to keep the lights on two or three of the others. Eventually, those platforms have to go. I think what the industry is probably looking at is a period of time in the distant future when they'll be able to remove or contract to have removed more than one, because there's cost savings in that. But they will have to come down under the rules that they were constructed by. It's going to be a very costly project, but again, it's going to have to be done.
Now there's the question, who pays for that?
Well, of course, the people that are in charge, the oil companies, and I believe there's a fund set up through the state, a diminishing fund of some sort that will help assist in funding that too.
Yeah, I just asked because, I've done so many stories about mining ever mm-hmm. since Pebble popped its head up. And so many times, mining companies declare bankruptcy of their subsidiary that's doing the mining and move out and leave the cleanup to, the people who are left.
Yeah, that's happened here in the Cook Inlet. But as I understand it, responsibility transfers from the loser to the buyer to the owner. And a responsibility transfers right on up the line. I'm hoping that's the way the whole program is going to work. And as I recall, from the early days, there was a sinking fund created to assist in paying for the removal of the platforms.
Yeah, and oil and gas is far better regulated than mining, I think.
Mm, oh, yes.
Do you recall there was a gentleman years ago, when I was here before, who wanted to turn one of the platforms into a lodge or a bed and breakfast?
You know, there's been many, many ideas fostered as to what to do with the platforms. Electrical generating stations using tidal flows and control centers, hotels for tourism, things of that nature. And in fact, relating back to ARCO, when ARCO was in business, and incidentally, this building was created by ARCO. They donated it to the Economic Development District when they left. But ARCO agreed to donate one of the platforms to the community college at the time, at the University of Alaska. And the idea was to use it for a training platform. We could take people out there. As you well know, we had a large, very, very well-received oil industry class down here. And we would use it as a training center. So my question at the time was, that's really great. We can use the gas production from the platform to help pay for the operation. And I was told immediately, no. We're going to let you have the platform, but you don't get the gas. The gas is ours. So that left a great big hole in any budget that you'd have to run, because they are very expensive just to keep the lights on,
I bet. Linda, we were talking about the other scholarships besides the one with AvTech. What are some of the other things that, and who are they, who is eligible for them?
Well, we have two additional scholarships that we developed in honor of former board members and volunteers. And one is called the James Carter Memorial Scholarship, and that is for students who are embarking on environmental studies. And then the other one is called the Captain Barry Eldridge Scholarship, Memorial Scholarship, and that is for maritime and vocational studies. Every year we have a committee that reviews applications. The applications will be available at the beginning of the year, and we'll make some announcements to let students know, prospective students know, that they're going to be, they can be considered. They do have to be Cook Inlet residents. I think graduating seniors or college students, they can also be, from home school. It doesn't have to be any particular school. But we do have all the specific requirements. The one at AvTech is a little different, and that's going to be administered by the Maritime Training Center. And that is also going to be, they're anticipating they're going to be distributing that one by December of every year. And there's going to be a different requirement for that one. So those are the three scholarships that we're involved with, and we're very proud of them, and we are very proud of the students that apply. They're just remarkable kids and remarkable people. So we've been, this will be our, let's see, we've started our scholarship program in 2015.
Oh, okay. So, like, the first one who's going to graduate may come back soon.
Yeah, there you go. So we like to keep up with some of them, too. I do a newsletter monthly or every other month, depending on what's going on. And sometimes we'll have a profile of I'll always have a profile of the students who've won. And so people will hear more about the scholarship program in the coming months.
How big are those scholarships?
These are $2,500 each as well.
Oh, okay. You know, and named after two very, very fine gentlemen that I knew when I lived here before. I served on the Planning and Zoning Commission with Mr. Eldridge.
Yeah, he was. I did not have the pleasure of meeting Captain Eldridge, but I understand he was remarkable.
Mr. Williams appointed me to the Planning and Zoning Commission. And the Ports and Harbor Commission, Committee, rather. So, well, what other projects have you got going? We've got about 15 minutes, so we can probably dive into some of the other works that you're doing.
Well, right now we are doing some upgrades, some much-needed upgrades to the ICE camera network. We are going to be putting in a new camera. And our director of operations, Vinny Catalano, just in the office just a moment ago, showed me one of the corroded cameras that was taken down from the ICE camera network. So some of these improvements have been long overdue. So the camera network is expanding, and we're excited about that.
How many cameras do we have now out there?
I think eight.
And eight cameras?
Eight or nine. So we're going to have another one. We're working with Hillcorp to install another one as soon as they're ready for us to do that. So that project has been immensely valuable to the NOAA ICE forecaster, who can access the visuals and then relay that information to mariners who are transiting the inlet during the heavy ice season.
And those cameras are ranging all the way from the port in Anchorage all the way to the mouth of the Kenai River. So we have a camera there. We have cameras on the platforms, cameras all the way up in Anchorage, so that a full forecasting of the ships coming in through the ice can be monitored.
Wow. You guys have a lot of cool measuring things that a nerd like me would like to look at on the web. Are these things available for innocent bystanders or just for industry?
Right now, I think the cameras are only available to the weather, NOAA, but we're trying to make them more accessible so that other people can use the visualization. But I don't know where that's at right at the moment. Right. Of course, then you can also download the Cook Inlet Response Tool, the Shore Zone photographs online. Those are available to you. We have a lot of information. We're also working on something called the Geographic Response Inventory Database. That would be something that would be available for oil spill responders in the incident command system, where you can just access what's available for your responders, for everybody who's working on that an incident. That's another project that we've got underway. We're going to be getting more information on that at our next board meeting, I believe, or sometime in September, do some training on that. Let me think of what else we've got going.
Well, let me ask about the ice camera some more. Were those put in response to that grounding a few years ago, or were they up before? What ship was that grounded we're talking about?
That was the,
We had it a little while ago.
Yeah.
Little
you mean the Seabolt Pride?
Seabolt Pride, yeah. I'm not sure if we actually put them in as a result of the Seabolt Pride. I think that came later. But it certainly prompted us to say, you know, there's something here that we could really take a look at. Ice has been a formidable issue in the inlet for many years. It's cost millions for the platforms to have their legs skirted and, you know, make sure the integrity of the platform so they didn't fall down because of ice. So it was a well-thought-out, well-planned project. One of the other ones that I wanted to just move a little ahead on is this whole issue of the shore zone mapping, how critical that has become. If you can imagine when the Exxon Valdez hit the reef over there, there wasn't one bit of data available as to habitat, locations of a safe harbor or anything of that nature. NOAA had been doing some work, but not the immense amount of work that should have been done. Today, we now know more about the Cook Inlet, its habitat, the areas of refuge, the materials that are there, the life forms that are there, than any time in history. There was virtually no database at all when we started, and we now have a very large database that is available for people, something you can go to the internet and look at.
I've seen some of the pictures. It is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually had we've had several exhibits based on the photographs because we have mounted them. We had one here at the Kenai Convention and Chamber of Commerce
really?
Visitor Center a few years back. It was great. I think that was during our 25th anniversary that year. So,
oh, okay.
And that's so it's been 5 years next year. Right. Already going into 30 years. So. I think something, too, that's important to mention, and this is ongoing and it's one of our most important responsibilities, is the contingency plan review. And we review all the oil discharge and prevention and contingency plans in the region, and also participate in regulation development. So we play an important role in reviewing plans in advance, and we comment very vigorously with each of these plans. And these are also on our website and available for people to review if they want to see where we had concerns, what we recommended, and to make these regulations and these C plans stronger than they probably could be, would have been had we not taken a very good thorough review.
Right. What form does that, how is that review done? Do you have scientists on staff who analyze things and then reports to the board and
we have a very thorough review process. We also work with contractors and then with in-house expertise. And then the review is run through the Protocol Control Committee that, and that's a committee of the certain board members who will go pour over line by line by line with the explanation of what the rationale is for that comment, and then they will either revise it or edit it to their liking, and then when it's finalized they'll approve it for submission.
And also once a year, well, we meet three times a year, but during that period of time we get reports from all of these committees, so it's kind of a step up thing. What's been done is reviewed by them, presented to us for our final approval, and it goes right on up from there. So there's a lot of oversight to this whole thing.
I was just about to ask you about oversight. Relationship with industry, I think we were talking about during the break. Change as the players change, as the owners, because the owners of all these refineries up here have all changed over time.
That's correct. And, I'm very pleased to say that when we have our meetings, there are invitations sent out to all of the players. And many times, practically every time, we have representatives from the major players that come and present to the board so that we know what their plans are and what their projects are and how they're moving along. For example, the pipeline. We were right in tune with the development of the pipeline from the very beginning, from the time that it was decided to abandon Drift River until they finally put the oil through. So, yeah, they come to our meetings every time our main board has meetings.
Wow, terrific.
In fact, I might also promote the board a little bit. We will be meeting in Seldovia on the 6th of September. So we'll be having our mid-year meeting on 6th of September in Seldovia.
Okay, so three Fridays from now. What are they going to do when the governor shuts down the ferry system and you can't get to Seldovia anymore?
Well, there's a private ferry system. Where
is there?
Fly.
Yeah, oh, okay.
We're not concerned about that. We're concerned about the ferry being shut down, but we're not concerned about getting to Seldovia.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good to know. What does it look like for the future?
Well, we're going to be here as long as there's oil being delivered. And if it comes down to the very end and there's only one person delivering oil, we'll still be here. And even after that, there'll be more that we've never discussed it, but I imagine there'll be a wind down phase when everything that we've been done will be cataloged and placed into future records for future review and things of that nature. But as long as a barrel of oil moves up and down that inlet, we'll be here.
Is your milieu only out in the water, or do you have anything to say about shore-based drilling and pipelines?
You know, we're charged with transportation of oil, and we've had some discussions about transportation of oil on land rather than on water. I think that we monitor it, but I don't think we get nearly as involved in the trucking.
We review regulations for onshore facilities as well, and contingency plans for onshore facilities as well as offshore.
Yeah, in the event of spills, of course, because understanding the geography, if there's a spill anywhere onshore, it's going to wind up offshore if it's allowed to escape.
And our mission is representing citizens and promoting the safe transportation and production of oil in Cook Inlet. So it's both production and transportation.
Now, is it just oil or oil and gas?
Just oil.
Oh, really?
Just under the Oil Pollution Act, we are mandated to oversee and monitor oil activities only.
Well, we're going to have to take another hour here so I can ask you about why you don't cover gas.
Well, it's not in the Oil Pollution Act. It's not in our mandates. We have to adhere to our mandates, so that's an easy answer. You don't even need an hour for it.
Well, that makes sense.
I went to an offshore class one time down in Texas where we looked at LNG as a danger to the inlet. And what we found, interestingly enough, is if you crack a tanker open and you spill that LNG into the water, you'll wind up with a great big ice cube, and that's about the end of it. You know, you may be lucky you get away without an explosion and fire, but it's going to freeze the ocean water, and that's not going to be much of a contaminant.
Oh.
So but it's the bunker fuel, it's everything.
Yeah,
else
it's
that runs
the bunker fuel that we're more worried
runs
about.
Runs the ship, right?
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, I remember one time going on a tour of the LNG plant up there, and they took a cup of the liquefied natural gas and poured it into a snowbank. Mm-hmm. And then the guy with like a long torch lit it on fire, and it made this whole snowbank glow from the inside. And you could feel the heat 20 feet away. It was amazing. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in. Linda Giguer, the public outreach coordinator with CERCAC, and John Williams, the board president of CERCAC. Earlier, we had Mike Munger, the executive director of CERCAC. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Jay. Always a pleasure.
This episode of the Kenai Conversation was recorded on Wednesday, August 21st. Be aware there may be dated references that are no longer timely.
Reminisce each Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. with Sal Cassano as she features the artists and their music of yesteryear. Learn fun facts about all your favorite dead musicians right here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.